Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
We are seeing topsoil moisture very short to short now, 20% or greater in all 11 western states.
USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey.
Those numbers pretty dramatically high now in the northwest, 63% very short to short in Washington, 61% in Oregon. As we move to the plains, we're seeing that dryness extending across the Rockies into Montana, where statewide topsoil moisture is 71% very short to short. Elsewhere across the plains, dryness is most acute across parts of the north, with a range anywhere from 24% very short to short in South Dakota, all the way up to 71% in Montana. Also seeing a subtle drying trend taking place in parts of the Corn Belt, leading the Midwest this week, Illinois 43% very short to short, and also seeing just some patchy dryness starting to develop in the south.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
U.S. has collected $100 billion in tariffs so far this year. That's according to Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, and expects to reach $300 billion by year's end. Over a 10-year period, the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, estimates total revenue from tariffs could top $2.8 trillion. President Donald Trump has said August 1st is the deadline for current tariff negotiations. Now, new tariffs include a 50% levy on imported copper. That's also effective August 1st. That rate will also apply to imports from Brazil, which the U.S. cited for unfair trade practices and political concerns. Brazil plans to respond using its reciprocity laws. Additional tariffs announced include 30% on imports from Algeria, Iraq, Libya, and Sri Lanka, 25% on Brunei and Moldova, and 20% on the Philippines, Sri Lanka, which sends about 40% of its garments to the U.S. They're seeking further talks, citing the 30% rate as a disadvantage compared to regional competitors. Now, India is still in talks with Washington, but has yet to reach agreement. Disagreements center on ag, dairy access, and competing tariff rates for major trading partners like Vietnam and China. Well, U.S. livestock trade through southern ports of entry once again suspended after Mexican authorities confirmed a new case of New World screwworm in Veracruz, just 370 miles from the U.S. border. The detection is the latest in a series of northward New World screwworm findings and undermines earlier port reopening plans from USDA. The phased plan, which started earlier, aimed to reopen five ports by mid-September. That timeline, though, is paused to allow for additional quarantine and control efforts in affected regions of Mexico. The initial port closures went into effect on May the 11th. USDA strategy includes strengthening sterile fly dispersal operations and expanding domestic capacity. A new dispersal facility under construction in South Texas, design work is underway for a U.S.-based sterile fly production facility. And the agency says Mexico must improve surveillance and containment efforts before border livestock trade resumes. USDA will continue on-site evaluations to ensure compliance. USDA's latest macroeconomic report forecasts a steady but modest economic expansion from 2024 to 2034. U.S. economy is expected to grow at an average annual rate of 1.8%, slightly lower than the previous decade. Report forms the foundation for USDA's long-term ag projections. Global outlook is also stable, with high and middle income economies avoiding major recessions despite recent inflation and supply chain disruptions. While growth continues, central banks beginning to ease monetary policies after a period of tightening aimed at reducing inflation. And slowing population growth in some regions, according to USDA, may limit long-term economic potential. Inflation projected to remain above pre-pandemic levels, although disinflation trends are expected to continue into the next decade. It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
My grandfather used to have this saying, it doesn't matter how you play the game, it's who keeps score. He thought that was hysterical.
Chairman of the Congressional Joint Economic Committee from Arizona, David Schweikert.
CBO projected when we did the 2017 tax reform, 2018, 2019, just before the pandemic, they were like 99.5, 99% accurate. Don't tell anyone because it'll make it harder for us to lie around here. And you get members saying, but over the next 5 years, they weren't accurate at all. Does anyone remember there was this little thing called COVID? Does anyone remember what Congress and the world actually did? We dumped how much cash into the world market. So you're accurate to hear, and then all of a sudden we dump how much cash. Do you think there's a chance when you borrow trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars, pump it out in the economy, you don't have your tax collections go up? How do we convince the American people we're serious about economic growth, productivity, taking on the debt and deficits, and not bankrupting their future when we spend almost every day saying, well, we don't like the scorekeeping? And then you look at every outside group, you know, the Tax Foundation, Yale Model Foundation, all these others, and it turns out CBO is more accurate than they were. I'm not standing here to be a defender of them. I'm being actually a defender of my brothers and sisters here. Please, I know it makes our lives easier when we can attack the scorekeeper. We can say, the scorekeeper didn't get it right. Therefore, pay no attention when they say we're trying to add $3, $4 trillion of debt. We're better than that. And there's a reason so much of the economic press is just mocking us and making fun of us. And you understand it's good politics. You get to go home, get in front of an audience that's not reading the economic press and say, well, they didn't get the accurate right. Let's treat our voters like they're adults. They understand what's going on. Look, these are the scores from Yale Budget, from Penn Wharton, from Congressional Budget Office, from Joint Tax Policy Center, American Enterprise Institution, Tax Foundation. And then here's what we're telling people. Is every other PhD economist wrong? Because it becomes an excuse not to do the things I was just complaining about when an idiot like me comes and says, I found you $3.3 trillion in savings. David, we don't have to do those hard pieces of legislation. We don't have to explain those bills to our constituents. We don't have to take on the lobbyists who are going to be all upset with us. We'll just tell people that it pays for itself. So everyone else is wrong because it makes our life as policymakers easier. But somehow we're going to have magic growth, magical thinking, when just today parts of the latest census data came out. Population 65 and older rose by 3.1% in the last year. Population 18 years old, under 18, decreased by 0.2%. I'm trying to make an argument that I love the partisanship. I love a good fight with my Democrat brothers and sisters. But what happens when the debt and deficits are demographics? But if we can blame the other side, we'll just do this ping pong back and forth. They're in charge, we're in charge, we're in charge, they're in charge. We'll blame each other. And then we're going to have a failed bond auction. Interest rates are going to explode. Remember, there's data sets, and I presented them here on the floor, that just a single point of interest going up over the next decade wipes out almost all the good we're trying to do extending the tax reform of 2017. There's a way to make this work. And I'm mentally just exhausted. Maybe I need to consume more coffee. Maybe I need to stop caring so much because I'm really worried. There's a way to make this work. There's hope. But what happens when no one will hear a word you're saying because it requires doing hard stuff and pisses off some lobbyists or some group that's in our office that wants us to regulate their competition's business or give them something? We used to be the party of fiscal sanity. I still think we are. We can get there. We can do it. Maybe we just need to understand the math.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
This chart here shows our top six markets for agricultural exports. They account for about two-thirds of our total exports.
Earlier this year at USDA's Ag Outlook Forum, USDA's Jason Halfmeister.
The dramatic line there is China in red, where you could see the dramatic fall with the tariffs in 2018 and 19, and then the rebound, which basically got us back to our traditional growth path. From WTO accession, and then the last couple of years. But so China in some ways exemplifies this topic, because when we lost the China market 2018 and 19, we were all scrambling to try and find alternatives. This is our top 20 agricultural export markets. I don't know if you can make them out. You see Mexico, Canada, and China. They're our top three. They're head and shoulders above the rest. And of course, China's now fallen to third, but Mexico and Canada are up there. So those three, they account for half of our exports, once again showing sort of a concentration, a little bit of exposure. And then you can see the top six, that's two-thirds of our exports, the top 10 and the top 20. So really two lessons for me out of this is one, like the need to be prepared if we lose one of these big markets because we can't easily replace them. And then second is that there is a lot of, this is a long tail, right, in this curve here. There is money to be made in those smaller markets. And so that comes together here when we talk about diversification. We don't want to sell less to China, Canada, and Mexico. This isn't your retirement portfolio where you don't want to be overweighted. Like, we want to sell more wherever we can. We think there is more business to be done in China, Mexico, and Canada. But what can we do in these other markets to build them up, to give us more customer base there? All right, so that was markets we look at. This is a way to look at it on products. So there's soybeans showing off, you know, on the far left there. They get their own metric, you know. It's too big. They blow everybody else. And then corn, beef and pork, tree nuts. So you can see here's ranked the products we're selling. So in addition to diversifying who we sell to, it's worth thinking about, do we want to diversify what we are selling? And so a couple ways to look at that. One is, do we just want to sell soybeans, or do we also want to sell soybean meal and oil and biodiesel, or corn? Do we also want to sell DDGs? Do we want to sell ethanol? Do we want to sell corn on the hoof, you know, sell more livestock products? So there's certainly diversification within products, but there's also a possibility to diversify across products. And so, don't want to forget, so we got corn, soybeans, and, apples, pears, and cherries up here. So we got fresh fruit too. That's part, one of our candidates here. And so similar questions about how overweighted are we in a particular market, but also is there other ways to present what we sell? All right, so these are products. Here's another way of looking at concentration. This shows which products have 50% or more of our exports go to one country. So there's sorghum, like, oh my gosh, 90% of our sorghum goes to China. Right? 9 out of 10 rows planted to sorghum is destined for China, very, very exposed. And you can see as you go down the chart there, sort of who is relatively more diversified than others, who is more exposed. Same chart, just sort of flipped around the other way. This shows how many markets you sell to get to 75% of your total exports, right? So there's sorghum, one market, and that's more than 75% of our exports. And then you go all the way across here, poultry, where we're totally diversified, right? Lots and lots of small poultry markets for us. Take our chickenling quarters and our other poultry products. So, you know, these are measures of concentration. They get to this point about the exposure we have to bad events and how diversification should be part of our strategy. But not at the expense of selling less to the big countries. How can we sell more in other places?
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
When we started Medicare Advantage in 2005, it was designed to come in at 95% of the cost of fee-for-service, but its model was, we're going to incentivize the folks that manage the care to make money by helping you be healthier. The incentive was, we're going to help populations be healthier.
Chairman of the Congressional Joint Economic Committee is from Arizona, David Schweikert.
MedVac report for the beginning of this year. Today it comes at 120% of fee-for-service. Just that delta from the 95 to 120% over 10 years is like $2 trillion. So we spent 6 months writing the modernization, the Medicare, the Better Medicare Act, Medicare Advantage, to make it so it incentivizes to help our brothers and sisters who are 65 and up who choose Medicare Advantage, which is 55% of the population, to get services so they're healthier. The Joint Economic Committee economists say over 10 years, it's $1.76 trillion of savings over 10 years. Preliminary score from our conversations with CBO. It's not in writing. But pure preliminary. $1.84 trillion, making it the largest savings bill in U.S. history. And it doesn't take away a single service. It fixes the misalignment in the system. How many co-sponsors do I have? The bill has been introduced for 1 month. Remember, we're tough. We're going to help stop this borrowing. We're going to take on the debt. I have zero co-sponsors. We have visited almost 100 members of Congress and their offices. Oh, David, this is uncomfortable. It has big words. Oh, David, it has the word Medicare. I beg of you, understand the scale of this debt. I have people now that won't even look me in the eye as I walk down the hallway because they're fearful I might ask them again and again and again, will you sponsor this? You tell me you care. Help us. Help us do the right thing. And yet if I try to show what's going on, remember, our baseline is over the next 10 years, we expect to spend $14.67 trillion, on Medicare Advantage, not Medicare, just the Medicare Advantage portion. All we're trying to do is save about 10% of that. And that's the alignment of incentives. Stop telling me how much you care. Stop telling me you're a budget hawk. I'm a budget hawk. I care about the budget, but God forbid, I'm not putting my name on something that actually does something, because that's hard. I'm the guy in the 50-50 district. I'm in one of the most competitive districts in America, and yet I'm willing to stand up behind this microphone and tell the truth and actually put it on paper. My economists, we did a model over the next 10 years with what's happening demographically in America. We have a shortage of young people. President Trump said something that was brilliant on the campaign trail. He said it is insane. We educate people, we send them home to come, and then we send them home with their degrees from the American universities to compete with us. That sparked an idea, and then we got our economists to do the modeling. It creates about $150, $160 billion of additional tax receipts in the 10-year window. But in the second 10-year window, it explodes. So we wrote a immigration reform bill moving the American immigration system to a talent-based system. But it has the word immigration in it. So it scares the hell out of the political class, because the reporters will lie about it. The activists on Twitter or X or whatever it is will lie about it. But the economics are incredibly important. If you're going to move this country to raise its productivity so we can raise wages, so we actually can survive what's happening in the actuary reports of Medicare and Social Security, guess what? You almost can't close the numbers unless you do something like this. And the reason I'm doing this is we added the president's gold cards, but the skills-based. And I get people saying, oh, I don't know how I feel about that. How many of you have a Dr. Patel? It's meant to be funny. I'm from Scottsdale, one of the greatest medical communities in America. And a bunch of our great, amazing talent has come in from all over the world. Stop bathing in folklore and start bathing in math.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Diversification, I've talked a little bit about that. That's what this whole forum is about.
Earlier this year, USDA's Ag Outlook Forum. Ryan LeGrand, President and CEO of the U.S. Grains Council.
We heard Ambassador Dowd speak a little bit about how difficult India is. And even though we just opened an office 2 years ago, we've had a consultant there for 3 decades. We've been there for a long, long time, and nothing moves fast there. We still don't expect anything to move quickly in India, but we've seen President Trump say that he wants a trade deal with them by the end of this year. We would love to see that. They have real opportunities there and needs for products like sorghum. They don't like GM, so GM corn is really tough, and we'd love to get that in. But sorghum is an immediate opportunity. As they produce ethanol there, they've really been successful with their ethanol program. They're up to almost E20. I think it's about an E18 or E19, and they're making it all in India. Well, that's caused a shortage on their grain side. And their poultry feeders and their dairy industry needs that grain that's now being diverted to ethanol. So we see a real opportunity for sorghum, for distillers grains. And then they don't want to import any fuel ethanol. They're one of our larger industrial ethanol partners, importers, but no fuel. They want to make everything right there in India. That's Modi's slogan, is make in India. Well, they want to make SAF. They want to do clean cooking there in India. And so I think it's key to get our ethanol classified as industrial for those two applications and feed into an A2J alcohol to jet scenario for SAF and feed into their clean cooking market, which just 5%, getting 5% of the market, that of the folks that are cooking in their homes with wood fires, with coal, or in some cases animal dung. 5% of that market is 200 million gallons. So it's worth going after, and one that we're going to be pursuing. Mexico, we've seen in recent periods that Mexico has broken their own record for corn imports. Under phase one in China imported 21 million tons of U.S. corn. Just last year, Mexico imported 23 million tons of U.S. corn, a record and a very, very big success. Now, Mexico was an eligible market under ATP. It is not under the current RAP program. So we see an opportunity to hopefully include that in the future. And then ethanol we see as an opportunity for Mexico, too. They've recently passed a biofuels law to start incorporating ethanol into their fuel matrix. and we hope to be a part of that supply. RAP is the current program, and I think, you know, ATP was such a success that that this regional agricultural promotion program was rolled out. And it sets us up for a global trade reset under President Trump that we're seeing right now and continued market diversification. It's going to further accelerate our ethanol programming and promotion. RAP 2, there's been two rounds. We were very happy to see that EU was included in the second round. It was not in the first round, and it is in the second round. Countries that are still excluded include China, Canada, and Mexico. Here's just a quick look of the impact. The numbers are right there. Ag exports count has projected these numbers here. I can't read them from the screen, but the main takeaway here is that 1 to 24 return on investment. That's what they say that through studies that said that MAP and FMD dollars, it's a 1 to 24 return on investment. So I can think of no better investment by the USDA to continue this FMD and MAP program and even increase it as we go forward.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
If you actually take some of the policy we're working on, the baseline of between now and 2035 of the $22 trillion we're supposed to borrow, the higher interest rates, we come close. We're not exactly there. We come close to doubling U.S. sovereign debt over the next decade.
Chairman of the Congressional Joint Economic Committee from Arizona, David Schweikert.
What took us 240 years, that we functionally double it in the next decade. Now let's get to the really uncomfortable stuff. In 2033, so what is that, 7-8 years from now, there's a 23% cut coming in Social Security checks, meaning we will double, and this is our, we've had witnesses that did explain this to us, we will double senior poverty after 2033. Are we ready to do that? Is that moral? And yet, I will get folks who will say, well, if we just open up immigration, well, it turns out that's actually not the math. Because one of the real reasons they moved up the date of the exhaustion of the Social Security Trust Fund was actually flattening of wage growth. Turns out there's no free option here. So we have some charts and those things that show, here's people who are undocumented in America. They're working under stolen Social Security numbers. They're giving into the system, but they're never going to get out. And then you look at the suppression of wage growth. I know this is geeky, but I need to sort of lay a marker on it. The suppression of wage growth. So when you bring in millions of people across the border that have similar skill sets, and they're often willing to sell their skill sets for even less money, Social Security actuary reports now modeling a flattening of wage growth. That's one of the things that's actually shortened the life of the Social Security Trust Fund by a year. So next time someone says, oh, we just open up the borders, that will take care of the Social Security Trust Fund. Turns out it doesn't work that way. You actually didn't get anything from it. You did a suppression of working people's wages, and this one takes us out about a decade. And I don't know why people don't think, they don't understand these most basic economic, I mean, we all went to our high school econ class, right? And so here's what's coming. You got the 23% cut coming in 2033. But the one that's had almost no discussion about is the Medicare Trust Fund is gone in 2033. Meaning if it lives off of its income, its tax receipts from the FICA taxes, it's still 11% cut. Next time we get someone here saying, you know, we need more money for our hospitals, we need more money for outpatient surgeries, we need more money for hospice care, point out to them in 7 years, there's an ugly, ugly cut coming. This 11% shortfall isn't even in our long-run CBO projections yet, because a year ago, give me an idea how these numbers eroded in 1 year. I think it was 2054 was last year's actuary report when the trust fund was gone. Okay, so how many people over the last week, because this has been out for almost a week now, have you seen come behind these microphones and say, maybe we should all work together or actually do something that's mathematically honest? Or actually just even tell our voters the truth that in 7 years you're getting a 23% cut in your Social Security check. And by the way, another 11% cut in your hospital coverage and other things in the Medicare, because the Medicare Part A trust fund is gone. For those that don't understand, and that's most of us, in Medicare, the portion of your payroll tax that goes to Medicare, about 38-40% of it is covered by the trust fund. That's the hospital portion, as we typically refer to it. The rest of it actually comes out of the general fund. And one of the most difficult numbers I have in my data set here, because this is the one that I see people get upset about, what's the primary driver of U.S. debt? Interest? Healthcare. For every dollar you put into Medicare, you're getting $6 to $7 back. That delta is uncomfortable to talk about, but it turns out to be that in interest of the primary drivers.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Rangeland and Pastures nationally rated good to excellent 45%, up 2 points from the previous week. Very poor to poor ratings, 27%, down from last week's 29%.
USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey.
We see most states from the Rockies eastward showing rangeland and pasture conditions greater than 50% good to excellent. The only exceptions east of the Rockies are Montana, Wyoming, Nebraska, South Dakota, and West Virginia. And we are seeing numbers greater than 80% good to excellent in several states, including the Midwestern states of Missouri and Ohio, Alabama in the south, as well as North Carolina, and then several northeastern states, including New York and Maine. At the same time, seven states are driving that national number of 27% very poor to poor higher. In the West, mostly, they include Nevada and Arizona, as well as Montana, which leads the Great Plains, 59% very poor to poor. In the Northwest, Oregon leads the way, 40% of the rangeland and pastures in very poor to poor condition.